And we end this hour on a 1970s classic that feels timeless.
For all we know, we may never meet again.
For all we know, we may never meet again. This was the understanding every time the troubled, drug-addicted jazz legend Chet Baker said goodbye to anyone. The man of many struggles and two voices, his own and the sounds he alone could make on the trumpet. Born to be Blue is the title of a new movie about the life of Baker, played in an eerie, near-perfect resemblance by actor Ethan Hawke. He channels Baker's lowest of lows with the help of Jane, a composite of Baker's many love interests, played by Carmen Ejogo. Baker's pure melodic intensity and effortless talent cast him as a white intruder in the jazz world, an Eminem-like figure in the world of black bebop greats, Bird Parker, John Coltrane, and Miles Davis. The film is out tomorrow and was written and directed by Robert Boudreau. Ethan Hawke and Boudreau pick up the story between Baker's peaks, in his late 30s, having already fallen hard and with one great comeback ahead of him. Chet Baker is such an enemy of himself. How do you make such a character likable, Robert?
We chose a year or two in his life in the late 60s when he had to actually amount to come back when he had lost everything. I think by framing a character like that, you find empathy and you find sympathy. So I think that's the starting point. And then I think, you know, casting someone like Ethan and working with Ethan to find a multidimensional human being in Chet Baker, finding humor, finding all those different things, which, you know, he was a very charismatic, funny guy. He wasn't just strictly a doomed, brooding, mysterious guy. I mean, that was part of it. That was part of the allure of the music, because he almost had this blank slate quality that people projected onto him. But I think, you know, we really worked hard to try to find those different facets of his character.
When Miles Davis in the movie says to you, "You don't belong here.
Go back home to the beach, man. This ain't the place for you. Come back when you've lived a little."
It seems as though Miles is kind of foreshadowing, you don't have the toughness to survive what this life is all about. How did you see that scene?
It's interesting for so many reasons, one of which is that Miles is such a huge part of Chet's psyche. One of the times, Chet was playing with Jerry Mulligan up at the Lighthouse, and this whole West Coast thing was happening, and people were really loving it. And Miles came out there to play, but he refused to go on stage until they'd taken the Chet Baker 45s out of the jukebox and broken them. Chet wasn't even offended. He laughed and tried to play it off. He just admired Miles so much. And he kind of understood when he won those Downbeat Magazine Jazz Trumpeter of the Year, he apparently told friends, you know, he wanted to write Miles an apology letter. And Miles said, "There's 20 brothers you should write to before you even get to me." You know, and I mean, you know, and you are nowhere near, you know, Cliff Brown, Dizzy Gillespie, Louis Armstrong, you know, we're near the Jazz Trumpeter of the Year. And I think it made Miles angry that people were able to market a beautiful young white guy who's, you know, whose aspiration is to play like Miles. So it's like somebody imitating you, but they're selling more records than you. It would be extremely frustrating.
Although jazz had crossed over into the white culture long before Chet Baker came along, it seems.
Long before?
Well, maybe not long before.
The big band era had a lot of white aspects.
Yeah,
but,
sure.
But the big band era was also a more populist type of jazz. I think when
bebop
came.
Right. Yeah, but bebop, if we talk about Henry James and that kind of thing, yeah. I mean, for Chet Baker to get hired to play with Charlie Parker, was a coup d'etat for him. And that's really what angered Miles, you know, that Charlie was taking him so seriously, because it gave him keys to the kingdom. You know, he was a legit bebop musician now. And he was good enough to be. I mean, that's a great story, that the reason why he got that gig is because Chet was the only person that Charlie Parker had ever met who could play his solos back to him. And it was really because Chet couldn't read music either. He was extremely good with his ear, and Charlie had never seen anybody able to do that.
But Miles, you know, played with Zawinul and John McLaughlin and lots of white musicians. It was the trumpet that was the killer.
I think it was also what Chet represented, because there was this, you know, with Mulligan and all those guys, Chet kind of became known as the leader of this white West Coast sound. And it was that movement, I think, and Chet epitomized that, that probably angered Miles and the beboppers on the East Coast. And it became this West versus East kind of thing that I think the media like to play up. And, you know, we play that up in our movie a little bit because Chet had his big first famous showdown in Berlin in the mid-50s, which really did happen, was that kind of showdown of East versus West.
This is a beautifully musical movie. I mean, Chet Baker is an amazing player. Such a singing quality. Mm-hmm. I mean, Miles is very much an experimentalist and out there and aggressive, and just taking risks. Chet Baker takes risks, but...
But they're all deeply engaged in the melody.
Yeah, they are. That's exactly how you say it.
That's what I think makes him so approachable for new jazz listeners. Chet, Nina Simone, Billie Holiday are great entries into the jazz world. It takes you a while to really understand what Charlie Parker and Miles Davis are doing. And once you get it, the whole world opens up. I know for me at 18, when Bruce Weber's Let's Get Lost came out, that's when I first heard about Chet Baker. And I got a couple records, and all of a sudden I loved jazz. And all of a sudden I was interested in other jazz because I got it.
What about playing the trumpet?
I begged Robert to give me more time to be able to practice. When I started, I had this great trumpet teacher, and I was like, wow, this is really fun. I was like, well, if I had a year, I think I could really do something special. And my trumpet teacher said, if you had 8 years, you couldn't do anything special. I mean, it's really, really hard. So what I did is I learned, Robert gave me really clear cues that were going to be in the movie. It was about somewhere between 6 and 8 songs that were really going to be filmed. And I just tried to learn the fingering and to play those songs. I would dampen them so they didn't sound as bad. We would just crank up the music and I would play along to it. So the embouchure would be right. And for the most part, I would get the fingering as well as I could. And I would try to play along. The scenes where Chet's mouth is busted and he's playing horribly, I play all that.
Wow. There's a question that's asked in the beginning of this film by the actress who plays Elaine and...
Carmen Jogo.
Yeah, yeah. I want to know why the women stayed with you.
Yeah.
And that question never really gets answered in this movie, and I think that's part of its power. You still are left with this question of, why would you sign up for that? But you can't look away.
You know, part of the answer is just the allure of genius. And, you know, Chet was a rock star, and I think there's something very attractive about rock stars and anyone who's got this genius ability. And so that's a start. Never mind the fact that he was terribly handsome, very charismatic.
And broken.
And he was an outlaw.
Women have a bad history. He was an outlaw.
People love outlaws, like a rock star outlaw who's good looking. I mean...
Who needs to be saved? You know, I mean, that's a recipe for an attractive male.
But that's the amazing thing. That's another segment, I guess.
Yeah, it's a
personal story. Yeah. But the way you play it, and this is, I think, a testimony to your acting. I mean, you know, a lot of people play a character like this as a kind of a bipolar where, manic and genius and then vulnerable and in pain. You're so vulnerable and so fragile through the whole thing, even in your strength. It's an amazing depiction, I think.
Thanks. I would watch the interviews with the real person, you know. And even though, you know, if you read Deep in the Dream, the biography, he just sounds like one of the worst people ever. And you come across, by the time you get to Let's Get Lost, he seems kind of like a zombie, like a ghost person. And then I would read some other pieces from friends, and I'd read this little excerpt. I remember sharing it with Robert because he got stopped in Reykjavik. He was playing in Reykjavik, and the cops knew he was going to be trying to bring drugs in, and so they hassled him a lot there. But he already shipped the drugs. The drugs at the hotel. He wasn't worried at all. There were no drugs there. But they kept him there for like 5 or 6 hours. I was hypnotized by this idea that a guy would sit there at the customs things and sing and tell jokes to the guys, the cops, and have a good time. And every time I'd watch an interview with him, there was this person that I found very likable, no matter what I heard, and that was incredibly vulnerable. He put the best of himself into the music. I found that very moving.
He says about Charlie Parker that Bird never hurt anyone but himself. And then he says, just like me. Does that get him off the hook?
That's the kind of thing Charlie Parker would say about himself, and that's the kind of thing Chet would say about himself. You see that appear, just, you know, that's just hurt myself. You know? But you can't do that in this life. We're all too connected. When you have children and we have people who love you and when you have parents and you hurt yourself to that degree, we're connected and you hurt them. So it's a little bit of a lie. I mean, it's a lie that people tell themselves to make themselves feel good. But or feel better about their self-destructive ways. But I think it's a truism that people who are using drugs to that degree say that. But I don't think it's an accurate truth.
Mm. There's a lot of dentistry in this movie, Robert. And, yeah. And it's partly unique to this Chet Baker story is that, you know, his self-destruction also kills his art because of this intimate relationship between the mouth and the trumpet. And what you have to go through to try to get that back if you've had your teeth knocked out, you really dive into that. It becomes kind of a metaphor of the brutal way in which he claws himself back.
Well, I think teeth were always a big thing for Chet Baker because when he was young, 9 or 10, he did lose his middle tooth. That kind of helped him develop his unique, slightly flat sound. I think a lot of great musicians over time develop their own sound because of certain things like certain left-handed guitar players. And the list goes on and on about unique musicians who approach their instrument a little differently, and that gives them a unique sound. Chet always had issues with teeth because of that. And so when he actually loses them all and he's got to replay with dentures, you know, we spent a lot of time working on appliances and dealing with a missing tooth. And it's we really did get preoccupied with the dentistry of it all because it's a critical part of his story. It's like there's a line in there that Callum Keith Rennie, who plays Dick Bock, says, it's like a piano player losing their hands. And it's hard for people to understand that don't play the trumpet how important the embouchure is. And we tried to teach them that a little bit, but it really was like he was learning to play from scratch.
And no, I played trombone in high school, and this tooth is one I lost in third grade.
And plays a factor.
And oh, when it would loosen up, I mean, it was like, you're not playing. And yeah. You'd have to go back to the dentist.
Well, that's what was happening to him. That we put it in the scene with Dizzy, you know, but he really did teach himself three different embouchures because each one would get so tired. And it, what I find mysterious and beautiful and strange is that if you watch the Live at Tokyo performance, his last, you know, one of his last recorded performances, it's magnificent. I mean, yes, he's a ghost. If people are listening, and listen to his Almost Blue by Elvis Costello that Chet plays at Chet Live at Tokyo. It is one of the most beautiful pieces of jazz music I've ever heard. And this is a person who's playing with three different embouchures, a full mouth of dentures. He's lived this epic life. You know, people ask me about, you know, you made the short film about the end of his life. Linklater had approached me years ago about the early 50s kind of beat movie. There's another, his friendship with Dick Charchik, whose name I can never pronounce, but in Paris, that album Chet in Paris is a whole other movie that you could make. His relationship, the real relationship with his wife and kids is an amazing story. This guy had chapters of his life that were really magnificent, but that it's so mysterious to me that he could play so well at the end of his life after all this.
You really take pains to make this an American story. The scene when he goes home to his parents, who are straight out of a Grant Wood painting. I mean, whoa.
He's from Yale, Oklahoma.
Oh, man.
He used to call it the armpit of America.
And the mom hates the wife. And the dad
hates
the son.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, oh, man, you're just waiting for the tornado to come and, you know, the house to
just
go off and
away.
Land on the witch, you know. It's just really something else. How did you decide to do the time shifting with the color and the black and white and the way in which you kind of go forward and backwards in time?
Well, I think the starting point for all that is just William Claxton photos from the 50s. Almost all the visual iconography of jazz in the 50s is black and white. It's almost impossible to find a color shot of Chet in the 60s. And so that was really important for me to try to capture that, was to use black and white. And because there's a film within a film, it's a perfect device. And so the black and white is something that we use for that part of the movie. And then the other parts of the film, which are in color, we have, you know, three different locations. We have California and New York. And narratively, there's a battle between the two. And visually, I think, you know, California is just very much open sky. You know, you have the warm sun. And New York is that noir-y claustrophobic feel. So we wanted to kind of contrast, I think, some of the visuals with that. And then with Oklahoma, because we only frame the story in the 60s and there's no childhood flashbacks or anything like that, the Oklahoma was the one chance for the audience to get to know or imagine his childhood, imagine his life, his family. And it's all compressed into like 5 or 6 minutes. And so it's loaded with that kind of story. And, you know, we actually shot the movie up in Canada. And so one of the great challenges we faced was trying to create this Americana story. It's like everyone does it in the movies. You have to create this illusion of a different time and place.
Scene of the pigs, where you cut away to the pigs. I'm sure they were real.
I was playing somewhere over the rainbow,
too. Ethan
loved
those pigs. I loved them.
It really put you, you know where this guy comes from.
Yeah.
It's really brilliant.
And there's something fascinating about imagining Chet Baker at this farm in Oklahoma, just dreaming of Europe. Europe seems so far away from that farm, doesn't it? And, you know, the nightclubs of Paris and Italy, and it just seems so far away.
And his dad's never going to get it.
Never going to get it.
I think it's one of the great contradictions of his character that makes him sympathetic and appealing is that he is this kind of square-mannered farm boy who is now the prince of cool. And you could always see it, even in Let's Get Lost, there's a formal mannerism about Chet that comes from that Oklahoma background that is part of the story.
Like, thank you, Bruce. Thank you for making the documentary about me. I mean, that's a very you know, mid-America thing. Yeah. Nobody says that.
Contrast this with Boyhood, which was very successful, where it seems like you would take that character down from the shelf every couple of years in film and knit it together is very strong. Here, this is all very, very intense in a very short period of time. Yeah. What's that contrast like?
It's the difference between a sprint and a marathon, I guess. The joy of something like this is the level of the challenge. I mean, we're talking about such an enigmatic person. We're talking about a person who's in a small community, extremely famous, and people have passionate feelings about. So the stakes are kind of high about playing it. I don't know. It's the strange thing about my job is that if I compare it to Boyhood, yeah, I can make some differences. But the thing about acting is it's always changing. I mean, it's similar, but when you're playing Macbeth at Lincoln Center, that's a whole other set of challenges, a whole different world. All of a sudden you're working on language and voice and speech and sword fighting, and it's a whole – I mean, so what's fascinating about my job, I did a remake of The Magnificent Seven this year, and it's all about horseback riding. It's like, yeah, I can do that speech, but can you do it riding at 20 miles an hour on the back of this pony? You know, it's hard. But that's the – it's the joy of my life and just a mystery. My wife kind of can't still get used to, like, how much our life always changes. It's just always shifting. Okay, we're going here. Okay, we're going there. And I just have to throw myself at it. And each one, I learn things. And if you're interested, like the work on this movie was interesting to me because I love music. So it wasn't painful to do the research and watch all the Miles Davis documentaries and watch the different, figure out who Charlie Parker is. I enjoy having an excuse to do that.
It's a directing challenge. This guy's got a lot of ideas here.
He
kind of goes off on his own. He's probably got a lot of ideas about how the script should sound, you know.
Yeah.
How does that work for you?
Well, I think thankfully I come from a very collaborative kind of approach to filmmaking with cast and with crew. And so very quickly I saw, like literally I think within the first 5 or 10 minutes of our meeting, he was overflowing with ideas. He had this past history with Linklater and he not only of collaboration with him, but of a Chet Baker movie with him. And so I immediately saw that there was like a wealth of knowledge and he could bring so much to the movie. And so I was just like, this is a great opportunity to improve the movie and build a relationship, which is what I think a director is supposed to do. And so it just became a process. And because he was in Toronto on this other movie, we spent a lot of the summer working, almost like workshopping the script, and we would have ideas. I could bring it back to him. And it felt like such a organic process that you don't always have that, and I always want to get that.
Because we hadn't worked together before, we had this kind of free grace period of where I was just in Toronto, and I wasn't working very hard and had a lot of free time, and we could meet and talk about the script. And one of the things that's amazing about Robert is because he'd put so much time researching it, there were a lot of different movies in your head. You know, there were a lot of different, and Chet's such an interesting person. Well, we could go down that road. And we got to just kind of sit there over coffee and kind of go, well, this would be interesting. This would be less interesting. How could these two ideas work together? You don't get that kind of process when the crew is waiting. You know, there's a certain stress that comes along. You have to be ready when it's time to shoot. But we had a little kind of free grace time where we could really be open-minded about what the movie could or couldn't be. The ultimate biopic is Raging Bull. I mean, that's the bar. You don't need to know anything about Jake LaMotta to find that interesting film. And we wanted to challenge ourselves. How can we make a great jazz? It's what that movie is to boxing or sports or life or relationships. It's just using Jake LaMotta to tell a great story the way Shakespeare uses King Henry IV to tell the story. It doesn't really matter who King Henry IV is. It matters the story you tell. And so we gave ourselves that challenge. What if we tried to make, let's look at Raging Bull. Obviously, we'll come short. What if it were that good? If it were that good, what would it be like? You know, and play that game with each other and really let the best ideas sift to the top.
I mean, if Raging Bull is the comparison, that bathtub scene, that's easily the same amount of blood as was Raging Bull.
De Niro on the ropes.
Yeah. De Niro on the ropes. You're trying to play the...
But, you know, all these things are, whenever you... tell a story, you know, boxing in that movie becomes a metaphor, the fighting metaphor, the, you know, music is a metaphor in this movie that other people can hopefully relate to. So it's about more than the life of one man.
Born to be Blue is the name of the film about Chet Baker. Ethan Hawke is the star. Robert Boudreau is the writer and director. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.